For the week of August 2nd, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 14, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in New York, I'm Michael Gills.
And today's a very special day, Sperling.
So I hear.
Because Michael is an official co-host of Showbiz Sandbox.
Yay!
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you.
You've probably noticed over the last couple of episodes that Michael has been introducing himself, including in this episode when we do the whip. So we just figured his insight is knowledgeable every single week, and it's always great to hear what he has to say about the entertainment news stories of the week. So why not just bring him on every week as an official co-host?
And he's funny, and he doesn't always agree with me, so I like that.
Does anybody ever always agree with you?
I hope not.
Not even myself.
Well, joining us today, Michael, is somebody that you know, Alonzo Duraldi. Now, Alonzo is not only the author of 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men, but he is also the film critic at MSNBC.com, a job he's been doing since 2007. His reviews are now featured regularly on The Rotten Tomatoes Show. A member of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, Alonzo spent 6 years as arts and entertainment editor at The Advocate, where he is still, like our co-host Michael, a contributing writer. His writing has also appeared in such publications as The Village Voice, Movie Line, Detour, among many others. Before life as a journalist, Alonzo was the artistic director for the USA Film Festival Dallas for 5 years. You can follow Alonzo on Twitter at twitter.com/MSNBCAlonzo. You can also visit Alonzo's website, alonzoduraldi.com. We'll place links to both of these in the show notes. Now, I was first called to the attention of Alonzo's work when Karen highlighted a link to a piece you wrote, Alonzo, called Do You See What I Twee? And why don't you explain a little bit about what Twee is and why you first started, you first decided to write this piece?
Well, I think Twee is sort of, it's not a specific thing to define, but it's like the guy said about pornography, I know it when I see it. it's this whole sort of chain of Sundance movies that are about soft-spoken, kind of, you know, nerdy guys who wind up falling in love with really hot babes who hide their super hotness behind fuzzy sweaters and cat-eye glasses. It's the idea where you have, like, the thrift store aesthetic, but everything is super art-directed, so it's at the same time kind of shabby and cooler than you'll ever be, you know, and very sort of, there's a lot of hipster to it, there's a lot of, post college sensitivity and it's sort of like it's a lot of the stuff white people like website, I guess.
So anything Michael Cera stars in,
for instance, yes. And if he gets a guitar out, you know you're in trouble.
Well, now you say in your piece here, the essence of Twee is avoiding the fashionable, the obvious, the predictable, the mundane, in an attempt to be, for lack of a better phrase, showily unshowy. Twee is the college girl who shows up at a party wearing vintage men's glasses and a 1960s nurse uniform. It's the guy reading the dog-eared and falling-apart 1959 edition of Camus at the Starbucks attached to a Borders. It's about replacing one calculated technique of visual and cultural cues with another. And I kind of, in my own mind, started to think of it as librarian chic.
Kind of, yeah, definitely. I think what it boils down to is the idea of it's two levels. One is that you're looking like, oh, I reject your mainstream fashion and your, you know, bright, shiny, mass-produced stuff, but I am replacing it with this sort of equally, you know, trendy and statement-filled stuff that I had to look a little harder to find.
So is Twee a bad thing?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think it's the kind of thing that can be overdone and abused, certainly. But I mean, you know, individually, a lot of the movies that I would accuse of being twee aren't ones I necessarily dislike. I mean, the trailer for Away We Go was this concentrated dose of tweeness that I thought I was going to hate the movie. And it wound up being one of my favorites this year, you know. It's the sort of thing I think you can get away with it, but when you start seeing it a lot, it's sort of like if you only hang out in Park Slope in Brooklyn and see nothing but hipsters all the time, they start getting on your nerves.
Now, one example that you used was Zooey Deschanel from 500 Days of Summer, among other things.
Who I love.
See, who I hate.
Oh, I love her.
She is the tweet it girl right now. I mean, she is sort of she's always kind of the dream girl in these movies for the twee heroes. You know, they haven't hooked up with Michael Cera yet, but, you know, just you wait. But, like, if you saw her in this rather annoying movie this year called Gigantic, and also in 500 Days of Summer, you know, she serves the purpose of the, like, the hip girl who likes the cool bands but will wear the 50s dresses ironically, but they also show off her rack, you know, that sort of thing.
And in real life, she's got her band. She's duos with M. Ward, so she's as cool as it gets.
Exactly. And she's even second-generation Hollywood, so it just gets better and better.
Right.
Is she so cool that she's uncool?
Well, I mean, I think that we're going to see the Zooey Deschanel backlash. It may already be happening. But, you know, I'd say so far, I mean, she, you know, I think she's mostly playing her cards right. I mean, you know, she, I don't think that you don't see her on, like, tons of magazine covers being like, I'm so effing cool, you know. But I can see where, like, she is some guy's dream girls and some girl's role model. And then for other people, like, oh, God, enough with the Zooey Deschanel already.
Kind of like the way people were with Parker Posey back in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
Yeah, she definitely, and she also in the same way straddles that kind of indie Hollywood divide where, like, you know, she'll go be in the Yes Man with, you know, Jim Carrey, but then she'll turn around and be in, like, you know, 4 Sundance movies.
Well, now, as I was reading your piece, I immediately thought of Zooey Deschanel, and then, of course, toward the end of it, you mentioned her, and I was also thinking, well, gee, I guess that 500 Days of Summer movie has gotta be twee, because it's got the parentheses around 500, and sure enough, in the last couple of graphs of your piece, you mentioned that it is, indeed. actually, let me read that here. What's the future of twee? If the trailer is to be believed, it's going to be 500 Days of Summer. It stars Zooey Deschanel and Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It premiered at Sundance. It's not a love story, it's a story about love, Semi promises the trailer tagline. And those parentheses in the title? Totally twee.
I had not seen the movie yet when I wrote that, I have to say. And the movie is maybe not quite as twee as I would have imagined, but again, it does this thing where, and I like this about the film, they shoot Los Angeles in a way I've never seen before, where they make it look like a real city. I mean, it's all takes place downtown in these lofts and in parks. Nobody drives anywhere. But again, it sort of embraces that twee aesthetic of, like, you know, we're not going to be flashy, we're not going to be showy, or do things that, you know, that anything that looks expensive. But on the other hand, if you want a thrift store vintage outfit that is this awesome, you're going to have to pay some money anyway.
Right, well, and that's actually, it's funny you should mention that whole thing about Los Angeles and the way they shoot it, because in Friday's Los Angeles Times, Christopher Hawthorne, their architecture critic, wrote a whole piece, and at first I thought it was a review of the film, which seemed odd, but really it was a review of the way that film portrays architecture throughout the film. And the more I thought about 500 Days of Summer, and I went to see it specifically for this podcast, and I knew we would be talking to you about it, so I thought, huh, you know, this particular film, every last detail was thought of and calculated. Every last detail was designed. It's like Apple. the way Apple, everything is designed to within an inch of, you know, being the perfect product.
Is that twee?
I think it's only twee when you put that much effort into it, but try and make it look like you didn't. That's sort of the inherent contradiction of twee, is that it is as art-directed and as assembled as a fashion show, you know, or, you know, something like, you know, The Real Housewives or NYC Prep, where these people are obviously out to show you, like, their conspicuous consumption. This is almost sort of like stealth conspicuous consumption, because, you know, the idea is, oh, no, I reject, you know, your fancy labels. I wear this old overcoat, but it happens to be an old overcoat that fits me perfectly, and then I had to go to 10 shops to buy, you know, to find.
And it's very expensive.
So it's sort of a new aesthetic, I guess.
Well, it's kind of like Abercrombie and Fitch. When I walk in there, I think, wow, they've really got the look that they want to get down perfectly tuned. Because
right. Well, and the whole notion of, like, people that buy jeans that have already been, you know, broken in.
Distressed.
Yeah. And it costs as much, if not more, than getting a brand new pair of, you know, Levi's 501s.
Although I will agree with you that all of the music these days is indie. I mean, you mentioned Twee has many cultural roots from the phenomenon of quote-unquote alternative becoming a category for the mainstream music industry in the early 1990s to the deadpan eccentricity of the 1980s films of Jim Jarmusch. And I have to say, every band that I'm listening to, they consider themselves an indie band. Nobody's ever going to go out there and say, I'm a pop band, like R.E.M. or
well, R.E.M. was an indie band.
Christina Aguilera. Well, R.E.M. became a pop band.
Yeah, I mean, basically, unless you're trying to sell records to 12-year-olds, I don't think the Jonas Brothers are going to call themselves indie. But yeah, it's sort of indie by default now. And it became a brand because I'm old enough that I remember when that was called college music, the 80s. And it was you had to listen to your local college radio station way in the low numbers of the FM dial to hear, the Replacements or R.E.M. or whoever. But then when alternative became a thing that you could market, the idea of being non-mainstream, which by virtue of being marketed would somehow make it mainstream. That's the whole sort of Schrodinger's cat we're dealing with Twee, and that it is seemingly effectless and non-fashionable, but it is equally, if not more so, fashionable than anything else.
Actually, on XM Radio, the satellite radio provider, or I guess it's Sirius XM now that they've merged, but it's the satellite radio provider here in the United States. This kind of indie alternative music is actually played on a station called XMU, and the U stands for university.
There you go. So I haven't actually been able to see the movie yet, but I know all three of you have. What did you think of it as a film? Because I'm a big Joseph Gordon-Levitt fan. So Karen, I know you saw it. What did you think?
You should see this for Joseph Gordon-Levitt. He is adorable. He is sexy. He is effortless. And he reminded me a lot of Heath Ledger, ironically. He was fantastic. I would see this movie again strictly for him.
Has it made him a star in a way?
I think it depends. I don't think he's going to break out from this, and I also don't think he will probably break out from G.I. Joe, but it's definitely going to be a really good stepping stone for him to possibly break out. But I don't think he's ever going to be like Tom Cruise. I don't think he wants that.
Right.
What about you, exactly. That's what's so great about his career is I think he's really aggressively avoiding. I mean, let's remember, this is a guy who got famous being on a sitcom. And I this was another piece I did for MSNBC. I think he's really made some interesting choices to work with directors he liked, to work with material that he finds is interesting, without so much this sort of like, I'm going to do this movie and then this movie and then this movie so that I'm going to become a big star. Granted, G.I. Joe, I think, sort of stands outside of that, but we all got to pay the rent.
Yeah.
Did you like the movie?
Well, it helps him have the power to make movies like small, smart indie films like Brick and Mysterious Skin. You got to pull a Christian Bale.
I liked 500 Days of Summer. I think my thing with it was that if you're seeing this movie in your early 20s, you will go crazy for it, and it will become like this movie that you revisit throughout your life and that speaks to your heart in a way that no other film may have at that point in your life. And I think if you're over 30, you'll be like, well, this is nice and it's well done, but I've seen it before.
See, I am over 30, and I saw the movie and I thought, wow, this is something I have not seen before.
Okay, well.
Yeah,
it's kind of like Reality Bites, but with lots of style and design.
But the writing for this movie was so clever, it was so sharp, that really made a huge difference.
I don't know. I mean, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it while I was watching it. But the overall effect, it felt to me that it was it all felt a little familiar. I think it really wants to be sort of the new millennial Annie Hall, and I don't know that it quite reaches that height. But I mean, it for what it is, it's fine, and I totally see why people younger than I am will cleave it to their bosom.
Well, it's funny you mention Annie Hall because as I was watching it, there were certain sequences that were, in my opinion, influenced by or ripped off from Annie Hall specifically, and I don't want to give anything away, but there's a sequence where there is a split screen, and on one side is the main character's vision of what he wants to have happen, and then on the other side, the right side of the screen, is reality. And of course, they diverge greatly. And I thought, wow, it's exactly like that scene in Annie Hall where Woody Allen is talking to Diane Keaton, and underneath what they're saying are the subtitles of what they're really thinking.
Or the scene where they each go to their therapist and there's the split screen and they're talking about the same stuff but in a completely different way.
And that just goes to show it has been years since I've seen Annie Hall because I didn't even remember that.
Well, that split screen, what's really happening, what he wished was going to happen, reminded me of an Alanis Morissette video called Precious Illusions, where she does exactly that. So that's my generation for you. But my favorite scene in the whole movie was when, after they slept together, and he was dancing through the streets.
Right, there's a Bollywood scene, a little Bollywood scene.
I thought that was hysterical.
I'm a sucker for a musical number, I admit it, especially one that involves Hall & Oates. So yeah, for that moment, I was totally down.
Michael, during prep, you kind of mentioned a little bit about Alonzo as a journalist and how he is presently taking on the state of journalism the correct way.
That's right. He's the 21st century journalist. You have you film critic for MSNBC. You Twitter so people can follow you. You're on Rotten Tomatoes with, I think, about it takes about 12 people to review a movie. But, you know, you've got your website, which links to all these different areas. Tell us about all the ways that you keep yourself promoting yourself, getting yourself out there, all the different outlets you work for.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny. We talk about this jokingly, but I think people that are in the same boat as I am, but we kind of aren't kidding after a while. We talk about it's maintaining the brand, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, you just sort of got to find people wherever they are. You know, I had held out on having a Facebook page for the longest time. And then finally, last fall, I was doing a series of blogs about Christmas movies, which is to build up towards a book that I'm writing. And so everybody's like, no, that's the way to promote it. And so I got on Facebook and started posting links. And it did get people over to my other blog on LiveJournal to read it. And now I think I'm doing a lot more on Facebook than I ever was on LiveJournal. But yeah, you just have to kind of get up in people's faces as much as you can. And even if you're still writing, you know, if you're one of the last 12 people with a print media job, I think you've got to just to sort of let people, oh, hey, I've got this piece in this issue of this magazine or in this newspaper, go find it. And luckily, there are all these sort of hubs where people congregate and gather. And so it's just a question of, you know, constantly putting yourself out there, but also doing what you can to let those people find you and to reach you so that they're easier to reach the next time there's a thing, you know?
Well, now it's funny because I, the way I got in touch with you was through MySpace. I said, and not knowing that Michael knew you, Karen said, hey, it would be great to get Alonzo on the show. I immediately went to MSNBC.com and looked up whether there was an email address. There wasn't. I went to MySpace and sure enough, you were there, and that's how we wound up getting in touch with you.
I know, and sadly, I don't go to MySpace enough, or I would have gotten back to you sooner. But in my case, at least, I'm super easy to find, because if Google is to be trusted, I'm the only Alonzo Duraldi on the planet. Whereas my husband, Dave White, has a somewhat different, you know, situation where he's a little trickier to narrow down in the search engines.
Well, now, and I'm sure you're the only person that's written a book called 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men.
I hope so.
And as I was telling this to a couple of people, they started shouting at me, you know, wait, is Casablanca in it? Is it? And they would go through every movie that they thought should be in the book.
good, because usually Casablanca is the one where people go, what? Why is that in there? I don't get it. And then, you know, I have to explain it to them and they figure it out.
Midnight Cowboy.
Explain it. No, because I'm curious to know, how did you come up with this list?
Well, the list in general, I mean, it's super subjective, like all lists are. And I originally came up with it just because we had this sort of parade of bright young interns at The Advocate who were really sharp and savvy, but I was just always astonished at what movies they hadn't seen. I mean, anything pre-Matrix sort of seemed to be like, maybe, I don't know. I thought, well, surely somebody, you know, some old queen has to sit you down and say, you have to see this, this, and this. And so I said, I'm going to be that old queen. But Casablanca specifically, you know, I was watching it again with a friend, before when I was working on the book, and I was like, oh my God, Claude Rains could not be more in love with Humphrey Bogart for this whole movie. He's just like, you know, fawning on him. And so I just thought, okay, and they're the two that wind up together at the end. So really, it's their love story.
Now, would Twilight make your list of 101 movies?
Oh, God. My thing about Twilight, if you're already a fan of the books, then the movie takes it seriously enough, you know, to please you, and you'll be thrilled with it and you know, squealing through the whole thing. At least the audience I saw it with was. If you are not a fan, it's kind of hilarious because it's so straightforward and so humorless that you can't help laughing at it if you aren't taking this deadly seriously. But, you know, I know there was a whole phenomenon at Comic-Con this year, the Twilight is Gay shirts. And I got into kind of an argument with Chris Gore about it because he insisted that it didn't mean like gay as a pejorative. He meant that they were literally gay. And I don't know that they are. I think they're girly, you know, and I think that's why there was that upset at Con this year, all the nerd boys suddenly dealing with these like nerd girls invading their sacred space. But I don't know that it's really gay per se.
So then I guess you don't really care about one of the stories we have highlighted for this week is about Twilight and how... How do you pronounce that name, Karen? Rachel Lefevre?
Rachel Lefevre.
Was she wronged or uncooperative?
You know, I don't know the inside scoop on that one. All I know is that after the Terminator movie this summer, I would think twice about bringing Bryce Dallas Howard into your franchise.
Right.
She's a talented actress, but she might have a curse on her. I don't know.
Right. And I guess Rachel Lefevre or
Lefevre
was like, recast. Is that the case, Karen?
Well, what happened is that somebody just got this agreement that their actors, if they have a conflict that's 3 weeks or less, that they can do that movie or TV show or whatever. But anything more than that, they have to let Summit know. Well, Rachel had this tiny little movie called Barney's Version that she had agreed to do, but they had not gotten the official pickup letter yet. So she knew that it was going to overlap 10 days into Twilight Eclipse's shooting schedule, and yet she didn't say anything to Summit until she finally got her pickup letter and said, oh yeah, well, I've got these, you know, this 10-day conflict. And she thought that should be okay because 3 weeks or less, it should be fine. Whereas Summit was like, well, you knew that these 10 days were going to be while we were shooting, and so they fired her.
And they replaced her with Bryce Dallas Howard, Ron Howard's daughter, and also an actress she was in.
Is also, by the way, less than half the price.
Okay.
Bear that in mind.
Because she hadn't done the previous movies? Because she's actually a bigger name, isn't she?
She's a bigger name, arguably, except that Rachel was supposed to get something like $1.5 million, and they paid a hell of a lot less than that for Bryce Dallas Howard.
I see. I don't know. Yeah, because Bryce Dallas Howard, she was in Dogville. She was in that Shyamalan movie, The Village. You know, she's actually an interesting, you know, rising young actress. But yeah, she was in the Terminator movie this summer, and through no fault of hers, that movie was, you know, pretty crap. So I worry about bringing her in on a sequel.
Well, only time will tell whether the film Twilight New Moon is actually affected at the box office because of that recasting. I highly doubt it. But this week,
I doubt it. But there are Twilight fans out there who are just up in arms.
It's the idea of God forbid you change anything. You know, it's like, you know, I'm sure they were already like, if anybody dared stray from the sacred texts of Stephanie Meyer, they were going to flip out about that. And now that the franchise is rolling, the movies themselves have become sacrosanct as well. And so now you can't recast anybody.
Now, did any of you see Funny People? Because that won this weekend's box office. It made $23.4 million in North America, beating out Harry Potter, which made $17.7 million in its third week.
Well, we know Alonzo saw it because he reviewed it, but tell us.
Yes,
again,
I did. No, I was going to let you guys go first. I liked Funny People. You know, it's, I can see why it's not everybody's cup of tea. Even if you were a fan of the first two, you know, Apatow directorial efforts, The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, this one definitely sort of operates at a different pace. It's, you know, they work in sort of, there's a whole dramatic subplot about the lead character who may or may not be dying. You have characters who have a real capacity for being, you know, selfish and unpleasant and you know, inconsiderate of other people. But at the same time, it's always very funny. I didn't think it was too long, which some people said. I thought it kind of had an interesting sort of meandering pace, which I think all of Apatow's movies do. They don't hit the usual sort of ha-ha comedy beats. He takes his time. He lets things unravel. And I'm generally willing to go with him on it. And I really enjoyed the film.
Well, we should say it's 2.5 hours and it stars Adam Sandler. It, you know, I guess you're right. The film did divide critics. A lot of people just felt it was too long and just too pat, and it received some pretty awful reviews, and it also received some pretty positive reviews.
I hear that Eric Bana is really funny in it.
He is, and actually, you know, Bana used to have a comedy show in Australia before he came to the States, so he's got a background in it.
Well, he was a stand-up comic. He did stand-up.
Yeah, and he had a variety show.
Yeah, it's like, you know, he and Emma Thompson both got famous in their home countries for doing these sort of wacky comedy shows, but here we think of them as serious, you know.
My problem with the movie is that, A, I just don't feel like Seth Rogen is a leading man. He's just not that good an actor. He's just not that interesting to watch for a feature-length film. I had the same problem with him in the drug movie. And
I find him incredibly annoying.
Oh, yeah, I love Seth Rogen. I think he's really funny. I enjoy.
I like him as a supporting actor. I like him in little bits.
You know, I agree. I can take him in doses. I can't stand him as a leading man. He's not sexy or interesting or somebody I want to spend a lot of time with.
I disagree. I really enjoyed him in Zack and Miri. I enjoyed him in Pineapple Express. I mean, granted, you know, doughy Jewish guys have generally been my type, so I may have an advantage or disadvantage here. But I find him really charming. I mean, I've been a fan of his ever since Freaks and Geeks.
Well, yeah, that's why I give him love for Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, I think he's funny. I do. I just don't want to see him as a leading man. I don't want to see him all that often.
Well, fair enough. I've never gotten the appeal of Adam Sandler, although I did like him in this movie because I think he was playing a character that you didn't have to like, and so that sort of let me off that hook.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I get it, but I don't feel it.
I did want to like someone. My problem with the movie was that Seth Rogen behaves like a jerk to his roommate at the beginning of the movie, screws him out of a possible job, which is, you know, obviously wildly important. So that makes you sort of not like him. And then he never really sort of feels bad about it. He gets caught and he's sort of defensive. But that's sort of, you know, he's supposed to be the guy we care about. He's the decent guy that makes Adam Sandler start to behave better and befriends him. And at the end of the movie, he behaves like an idiot again. It just makes no sense, the climax of the movie. I don't want to spoil it, but it literally, he does stuff and it literally is nonsensical. It serves no purpose. It's just stupid. And Adam Sandler's mad at him, even though he's panicking over having to possibly be in a real relationship for a change. So it just doesn't make any sense just on a plot level to me. But moment to moment, it was better than I thought. What was interesting was the movie was such a disaster in the selling of it. The first trailer I saw was like, made it look like a Lifetime movie of the week where Adam Sandler's got this terrible illness and he's going to die. And then they did a new trailer where they don't mention anything about him being sick and it looks like a laugh riot comedy. And you know they got desperate and realized things were not going well as far as the tracking numbers. And they pulled it out. It did okay. You know, $24 million is not bad for an R-rated movie for Adam Sandler.
Although the whole box office this week was down 18% in North America. It was $125 million in Canada and the U.S. And Harry Potter, we talked about Harry Potter last week and whether it was opening on IMAX this week, and we talked about whether it would be, you know, given a boost, and it was actually given a boost. It opened on 68 IMAX screens, it looks like. It was, while it was down 40%, which compared with Order of the Phoenix's 45% in its third week, it climbed to $255.5 million cumulatively. I can't talk today. I don't know why. IMAX accounted for an estimated $3.2 million of that gross, 18% of this past weekend's box office. And if it wasn't for that gross, it would have come in third to G-Force, the guinea pig 3D movie, which earned 17.
I'm so bummed. Was not supposed to be all that funny. You didn't like it, right, Alonzo?
I was not taken with G-Force, and you know, I'm down for a guinea pig spy movie if it's well done.
It was funny, right?
Yeah, it was not very funny, and I didn't think the characters were, I didn't think any of the guinea pigs were particularly interestingly done. And then you've got people like, you know, Zach Galifianakis and Will Arnett, who are really funny, given these roles where they like have nothing funny to do. Like, they're totally playing straight man to these little CG rodents, and they're not funny either. And so, you know, until they get to the car chasing and the explosions, there's just not much to care about.
Rounding out the rest of the box office this week was, in fourth place, The Ugly Truth. It made $13 million. And Aliens in the Attic, $7.8 million.
What is Aliens in the Attic? Have you even heard of it?
I don't think they screened it for press. It has Ashley Tisdale from the High School Musical franchise in it.
The
effects looked terrible.
You know, of note this week, box office news-wise, was Ice Age Dawn of the Dinosaurs. It made $5.3 million in North America, which was down 37%, but its tally rose in the U.S. to $181.8 million in the first 33 days. And worldwide, overseas, I should say internationally, it's made $546 million, surpassing Finding Nemo as the highest grossing animated film ever.
Oh, that's horrible. It's so bad, that movie. I was bored out of my mind during Ice Age 3.
Okay, because I loved the first two, so it's not as funny as the first two?
To be honest, I didn't see the first two.
I want to talk about the Alien prequel and Ridley Scott.
Yeah, what do you make
and
of that?
And this is like the greatest, geekiest thing ever, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, so just to bring listeners up to speed, the studio has hired John, how do you pronounce it? Spites, to write a prequel that has Ridley Scott attached to return as a director. So it's not going to be after the first three films. It's going to be, or I guess there's four films that were made. It's going to be before Ridley Scott's original 1979 film.
Now, every guy I know is so excitedly geeked out by this. Me, I think it's great, but I honestly do have to be honest. I don't really care. What do you guys think?
Well, I love the first two Alien movies, but I just, you know, if Sigourney Weaver says she's not going to do it, which makes sense. And so that I care, that makes me less interested. And I feel like there's this crazy sort of dearth of ideas going on lately, where all we're getting now are these sequels and these remakes and these reimaginings and these, you know, TV shows, and you know, and for every Star Trek you've got to sit through 10, like, you know, Land of the Lost,
Transformers.
And even Land of the Lost was okay, but I mean, like Transformers, you know, do we need more toys and board games being turned into feature films, really? Is that what it's come down to?
Well, then I guess you're no fan of what was announced earlier today, that Spielberg is going to be remaking the 1950 film starring Jimmy Stewart, Harvey.
As somebody pointed out, that he's basically, you know, he remade Duel as Minority Report, he remade Close Encounters as War of the Worlds, and now he's remaking E.T.
And for those who have never seen Harvey, it was an adaptation of the Mary Chase Pulitzer Prize-winning play about a man, played by Jimmy Stewart, who befriends a 6.5-foot-tall invisible rabbit. And the project will be a co-production of 20th Century Fox and DreamWorks, and DreamWorks will be bringing 50% of the budget to the production through its new funding relationship with Reliance out of India. Now, here's where I think a question has to be asked, because now that DreamWorks has to bring its own money, and of course Spielberg is a big part of DreamWorks, the question that I have is Spielberg forced to play it safe, given that he's now an equity partner in each film that he's going to be doing, and he has to earn the money back? And is he sticking to material that's proven? Obviously, Harvey, I believe it won the Academy Award for Best Picture that year in 19... 19-
no.
No, it no. didn't? Okay. Well, there you go. I shouldn't...
Maybe he won. No.
Should have looked that up.
Oh, I thought it did, too. I thought it was like a dark horse that won.
Maybe it was Marty.
No, adapted screenplay or something, maybe, but not Best Picture.
Was it Marty that won Best Picture?
Oh, yeah.
Marty
that's
won
what
Best
thinking.
Picture.
Okay, that's what I was thinking of.
But I mean, Marty won, but not Marty. He always has commercial... broad appeal movies. You know, he makes a movie about the Holocaust and makes hundreds of millions of dollars. This is a man whose instincts are always strong and commercial, and he will make whatever movie he wants to make, and you know, he will make money on it.
Yeah, I don't think it's suddenly a case of him deciding that he's got to play it safe. I think he's always been very shrewd, very canny about what he makes and why, and his tastes and how they run with commercial tastes. So I would imagine he'll continue on his merry way, and you know, I don't think anybody looks at him as a risky investment for this sort of stuff.
And do we assume Tom Hanks will be the lead? Doesn't it just seem inevitable that Tom Hanks will be the lead?
Will Smith or Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks, absolutely.
I'm looking it up. The Academy Award that Harvey won was Best Supporting Actress for Josephine Hull.
So I wasn't entirely wrong, but mostly
it is an Oscar.
But we were definitely thinking of Marty.
Yes. Absolutely. But, you know, Alonzo, I think part of the issue here is that all of these studios, which used to be run by the likes of, well, Peter Guber and Louis B. Mayer and these huge personalities.
Peter Guber and Louis B. Mayer.
I was going to say, I don't think you're going to say those two in the same breath. In tandem, those two.
Because I couldn't think of anybody else on the spur of the moment. That's why. Daryl Zanuck?
Good.
Better?
I'm trying to I can't remember who was running Warner Brothers in the 80s and 90s. Oh, well, Bob Daly and Terry Selma. These were figures, Harvey Weinstein. These are figures that are almost larger than life. They're legendary. Now they're run by accountants, basically. You've got.
You know what? People were saying that when Semmel was running the studio. I mean, really, the bold, brash guys have not been running a Hollywood studio since arguably the 1940s or 50s. I mean, you know, Columbia, you know, was owned by Coca-Cola and then by Sony, and Transamerica took over United Artists. I mean, they're all divisions of these huge mega corporations, Warner Brothers included. And so I think it's been a long time since we've seen anything but, you know, number crunching. I mean, it may have gotten even worse in recent years, but the kind of, you know, legendary studio head that you're talking about is way, way extinct in Hollywood.
So you're okay. Well, that's.
Yeah, I agree. Look at Fox too. I mean, Tom Rothman, Jim Giannopoulos. I mean, all they care about is the bottom line. That's why Fox makes bad movies.
They're there for News Corp. I mean, I just watched finally last night that documentary that was on TCM about 1939 and how why it was the greatest year ever in Hollywood. And yeah, they talk about how it was before World War II happened. It was before before Congress made the studios give up all their theater chains, and it was before television. And those three things pretty much just like shattered the studio system as we know it. And to this day, you get somebody like Harvey Weinstein who shakes things up and works from the gut and you know got Disney to spend all this money on his stuff and did his crazy Oscar campaigns, but even he is not like a mogul of the Zanuck, you know, David Selznick, you know, school. Those guys are a whole other, you know, kettle of fish.
Also, the Weinstein Company not exactly making a lot of money.
Yeah, well, he doesn't have the deep Disney pockets anymore, so it's like his old playbook is not exactly, you know, working when it's all coming down to him, you know. And I mean, and Harvey, for him, you know, let's not forget, this is the guy who also chopped up movies without director's approval and would buy up films at Sundance in order to keep them from being competition and never release them, and they would just sit in a basement somewhere until, like, maybe they'd get an Anchor Bay DVD release. So, I mean, you know, I don't know that he's necessarily the one we want to point to as, like, our role model either.
Well, apparently Disney still has deep pockets because this week they announced that they are narrowing down the list of directors for their fourth iteration of Pirates of the Caribbean. Michael Fleming in Variety reports that Rob Marshall, who directed, he directed Chicago, didn't he?
Right.
Yep.
And he just directed Nine, which stars Daniel Day-Lewis, Penelope Cruz, Marion Cotillard, Judi Dench, Nicole Kidman, Kate Hudson, and Sophia Loren. The movie will be...
And Fergie.
And Fergie. That movie will be released November 25th, but it looks like Rob Marshall is going to direct the fourth iteration of the Captain Jack Sparrow franchise, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Maybe there'll be more singing and dancing this time.
Who knows?
Maybe it'll be actually entertaining.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the Pirates movies, and I suspect that really if there's an auteur behind these films, it's Jerry Bruckheimer, and that, you know, Rob Marshall would do well to not get in the way of the Jerry Bruckheimer method, because these movies have made $2.6 billion or whatever worldwide, and I doubt they're looking to change horses at this point. But, you know, if it helps his career, you know, more power to him.
Does anyone know why Antonio Banderas didn't get the role in Nine? I mean, he did it on Broadway and got rave reviews for that, you know, musical version of Nine. And I'm wondering why he didn't get the movie.
I suspect it was easier to sell Daniel Day-Lewis to funders than Banderas.
Do you think of him as a box office draw, though, Daniel Day-Lewis? He almost none of his movies make money.
Well, but he's a prestige draw, and this is a movie that's going to live or die by how it does at award season. And I think that Banderas, unfortunately, has, you know, his American career has been kind of spotty, and I don't think people look at him as a guy who opens movies. I mean, I think he's a great actor, don't get me wrong. I've been a fan of his since the Almodovar days, but I can see why they would have to go with somebody who was a more prestige name.
Yeah, Banderas is almost a joke at this point, isn't he?
Well, is, marrying Melanie Griffith, alas, did not help his career prospects. True. I suspect. I'm glad they're happy together, but and let's face it, the history of Broadway musicals getting turned into movies is the history of the original performer not getting cast,
even if it's Julie Andrews.
Even if it's Julie Andrews, exactly.
And it just goes to show you how people really, really feel about the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise. We started talking about Pirates of the Caribbean, and we are now talking about Broadway, you know, Hollywood interpretations of Broadway plays and musicals. So that's a sure sign that we should move on to television. Now, certainly, Alonzo, you're welcome to stay with us. If you want to jump off, I completely understand.
Oh, I'll just stay mum if we get to areas that about which I know zip.
Okay, well,
that's okay. We talk about areas we know zip about a lot. So.
I like that.
Well, does anybody know anything about the Emmys? Because that was, in my opinion, yes, one of the big news stories this week was that the Emmys, at least as a television show, the award show, it's going to be revamped. They're going to shuffle some of the awards that they present to before the telecast so that they can get to the juicy bits. And this has caused a huge outcry amongst the Television Academy members because, of course, this is supposed to be their awards and they're supposed to be honored on national television. And they've been kind of some awards will be sidelined.
Well, they basically cut the HBO category because HBO is the only network that's been competing for the last 10 or 15 years in miniseries and TV movies, and they get four or five of the nominations every year, and those are the long-form miniseries and TV movies were what they were going to shove off the broadcast, and HBO is saying, hey, we want to be on TV, and we've got all the big stars, and you know, you've got big-name people coming to the movies that you could have at the Emmys, but not everybody else doesn't care because they don't even compete in those categories anymore.
Well, and there's some speculation that there's going to be a quote-unquote interactive element with home viewers texting in votes for their favorite shows.
Ooh.
Ooh.
No, but you have to do that now. You have to.
Everything's American Idol now? This is crazy.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah, well, the Creative Arts Emmys are what Kathy Griffin terms as the Schmemmies. yeah, I mean, I think it's sad if it's just the major networks trying to ghettoize HBO for triumphing in a genre which they have decided to no longer try to compete.
Well, Variety writes here, the Emmy flap points up the eternal dilemma of televised kudocasts. Is the event really for the honorees, or is it an entertainment show? And the reality is, the second you put it on television and ask me to watch, it's a television show. It's entertainment.
Yeah, but this doesn't make it less entertaining because those categories have big names like, you know, Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson and all these people who appear in HBO movies and miniseries, Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg. And so you can have them on the broadcast and it draws more attention, you know, to those things because it's big
except
names.
Except for that a lot of those types of movies are, you know, really kind of after school, specially in my perspective, and kind of boring. And I don't really get HBO anymore. I mean, I used to, but I don't anymore. And even when I did, I didn't watch them. I always found those categories just incredibly boring.
Well, I don't know that that's really fair, though. I mean, because TV movies have a history of being sort of, you know, second-tier kind of stuff. But, I mean, HBO, I mean, we're talking about stuff like Wit and, you know, Angels in America. I mean, this is some of the best stuff I think the television has seen ever. And I don't know that I agree with Michael. If from a strictly, you know, mercenary standpoint, you've got big stars, you've got big names involved that are going to juice the show up and make it more interesting. It seems odd to sort of, like, create this, to de facto bring the Cable Ace Awards back by not letting, you know, HBO have their moment at the Emmys.
Well, now, did any of you care that HBO picked up some of its series, including True Blood, Entourage, and I guess a freshman show that has yet to be seen, Hung?
It's on the air. Hung is already
on.
Did any of you care?
It's on and doing well, from what I understand.
It's a big, thick hit.
Yeah, it's a big girthy hit.
I'm not even going to go there. I've never been an Entourage or True Blood fan, and I've seen the first episode of Hung, and it didn't grab me. But I'm going to give it a couple more before I quit on it. The current crop of HBO shows, I'm not really into any of them, but it's a cyclical thing, you know, because we could be, you know, a few years ago it was, you know, Soprano and Sex and the City, and I do like Eastbound and Down. Actually, I don't know if that's coming back.
Not so far. They didn't mention it so far. And HBO has had their moment in the sun at the Television Critics Association meetings, which are being held this week and last week. Which that's just a round of interviews and publicity tours that are done here in Los Angeles around right before the television season starts, and again in January before the midseason starts. And what Variety said was that this news represents how HBO has managed to get its groove back in recent months, with Plepler and Lombardo, the two heads of the network now, admitting the channel went through a rough patch in recent years, and not just because smash series like The Sopranos and Sex and the City had ended their runs, but also because of the sudden departure of their former head, Chris Albrecht. It forced them
to a very controversial figure.
Yes, he kind of left under controversial circumstances, in fact. They say that his departure forced a change at the top that took some time to get used to. 2 years ago, it was about us being new in the jobs, Lombardo said. It was a very sudden and dramatic transition at HBO in terms of programming executives, and we were the newbies. It was tough. It was a much more stressful TCA press tour session for us 2 years ago.
Well, they're just putting a good face on things, I think. HBO doesn't quite have their groove back. I mean, True Blood actually grew from its first season premiere to its second season premiere, and it's definitely growing into something that could possibly be a big hit. But Entourage is on its last legs. It's nowhere near as, you know, it was never a big hit, and it's not. It's doing lower than it was. Hung just started out, and they always give shows at least two seasons. And, you know, if True Blood is their biggest hit, that's like 3 million viewers. That's half or a third of what The Sopranos and Sex and the City were doing when they were at their peak. So, you know, they're still way down from where they were 10 years ago.
Now, Alonzo, are you a fan of American Idol? We know what Karen and Michael think of it. They can't get enough of it. Are you one of those Idol fanatics?
You know, I tell you, I would have maybe drifted away at this point, except for the fact that my husband covers Idol exhaustively for popnography.com. So I wind up watching it with him and like helping him be quippy about it. So I know way more about Idol than I should, but I don't know that I'm still watching, you know, under my own wishes.
Can you imagine the show without Paula Abdul?
I am horrified at the thought that they would think that Paula is replaceable because, you know, she just gives it that dose of crazy that makes it so watchable. And Kara, I was not impressed with her first at-bat this past season. She did not say anything that was very interesting. That song that she wrote for the guys to sing was dreadful. So if they think that she's going to be like, you know, the new woman and that's going to be their excuse for letting Paula go, that's a big mistake, I think.
Well, she's back. It was confirmed. Michael, I believe, has the news.
Well, Cara, they officially re-signed Cara Diaguardi. So I think they're in the midst of negotiating with Paula, and I think they're using a little leverage by re-signing Cara. They want to get Paula on the cheap and not pay her as much as they're paying some of the men. So they're putting the pressure on her by officially re-signing Cara. They announced that today. So there you go. I think they'd be crazy not to bring Paula back. What do you think, Karen?
I totally agree. I agree with what Alonzo said. It's because she's the crazy in it.
Well,
you
she
need
wants.
Paula.
Well, she. Well, I'm sure Fox thinks she's crazy because she wants $20 million, and they want to give her half of that.
Why shouldn't she get it? To me, this whole thing strikes me as incredibly sexist. I think I said that last week. Like, why should she not get it?
Yeah, she isn't Seacrest making 45 or something insane like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seacrest makes 45. Simon makes 145 or something like that.
He's negotiating for 145.
Yeah, and Randy should be making 30 or 40 million. It's the biggest hit, you know, on television.
Yeah, and frankly, Seacrest, I could live with that. You put Dunkelman back in there, I will still tune in. But Paula, on the other hand, really brings something.
Well, Abdul's manager, David Sonnenberg, says that she's, quote, not a happy camper. And Access Hollywood says, that may be true, but $10 million can sure buy a nice tent.
She'll be back. She'll be back, and they will pay her. They will pay her more than they're trying to lowball her. They don't want to look like jerks to Paula. And there's no way they will not re-sign her. They can't be that stupid.
No, you don't mess with a winning formula.
Yeah. Well, now, something that didn't appear on TV, but it appeared on the internet version of television, YouTube, was a video of Jill Peterson and Kevin Hines' wedding. And it was their walk down the aisle to Chris Brown's Forever, a song released over a year ago. And the reason I wanted to talk about this is,
first of all, we should see if anybody has actually watched It Sperling besides you and me.
I did.
So, Alonzo, you've seen it.
Yeah, okay. It's cute.
So, yeah, I mean, just to give listeners some sense of what it's about, the bridal party kind of dances down the aisle to this song, and it's kind of funny. And
they're all white Minnesotans, it's worth pointing out.
Yes, that's definitely a big part of the funny. They kind of boogie on down, getting down.
Yeah, and at this point, over 15 million people have watched this on YouTube. And, I mean, the groom does a somersault out down the aisle, and the bride walks alone, not with her father. She dances down the aisle toward the end of the five-minute clip. But this is what I really think is noteworthy about this story, and the sound that you hear in the background is the sound of me getting out my soapbox, because, as Karen and Michael know, I have for months been saying that if you give it away, you actually sell more. And this song that's featured in this video is a Chris Brown song that's over a year old. After appearing in this YouTube video, it sent sales of this song to number 4 on the iTunes chart and number 3 on Amazon's MP3 store, and last Thursday was still at number 12. It's selling like hotcakes.
You should send them a gift basket.
Well, in the past, as the New York Times points out, Warner Music has had something of a, a vitriolic relationship with YouTube, and they've objected when people, or their cats, used copyrighted songs in homemade YouTube videos. Sony Music Chris Brown's label used YouTube's content management tools to claim the song and overlay a click-to-buy ad on the video, which directs viewers to download the song from either iTunes or Amazon, earning YouTube a commission. So, really, this may be a way that YouTube has finally figured out to make money.
Yeah, and to, you know, like, not be on the wrong side of copyright holders.
Well, okay, yeah. Yes.
It's at number 34 right now on iTunes, so it's still selling. It's in the top 40.
And I'd like to point out, as I was saying during prep, there is a group called Phoenix. It's an indie group, probably a twee group, but it's an indie band.
They're shoot cooler than cool.
Their latest album, Wolfgang Amadeus Phoenix, has a hit song on it called Listomania. A month before their album was released, it leaked on the internet and was pirated on the Pirate Bay and through BitTorrent, and you could get it for free if you wanted. It has been selling at a record pace, and yet people can get it for free.
And there's also a YouTube clip going around of that song to a bunch of like old Brat Pack movie moments, if I recall.
That's right. And so rather than squash these YouTube videos and these moments where you're, or these devices where you're giving away the content, these pieces are being used to help promote the content. It's actually working. And it happens time and time again. So that's my little rant for the week.
No, but I totally agree. I think that's the way to make money on the internet. You give it away for free, and then they will come back and buy more.
I guess it just goes to show people actually want a CD. They want something that they can hold in their hands that when their hard drive crashes, isn't going to go away.
I wish they felt that way, but my nieces and nephews have literally never bought a CD, and I'm horrified. I'm like, I mean, you know, if your computer crashes, iTunes will re-give you all your stuff that's on it because they have a record of everything you bought. But to me, like you say, I want to have a hard copy of it.
Well, so do I, but, you know, there's been a recent study says that teenagers aren't even necessarily getting their music off of iTunes anymore. They're not even buying it. They're only streaming it.
Yes, yeah. That is correct.
But somebody's buying it on iTunes, obviously, and it's not, you know, people that feel the need to own a CD, but who do feel the need to buy the thing and have a crisp copy of it.
Yeah, to own it.
Now, last week, we mentioned the Michael Jackson footage, the 80 hours of footage of Michael Jackson rehearsing at the Staples Center for his tour, which never happened, of course, because he passed away, and the fact that people were bidding on the footage to turn it into a film, a documentary, a television special. Turns out Sony won that auction. They're paying $60 million to release the film. It's going to be released October 30th. Patrick Goldstein of the Los Angeles Times, much like you, Michael, does not necessarily agree with that deal, but he says here, is it a good deal for Sony? The simple answer is nobody knows. There's really no precedent for the Jackson death mania, so it's impossible to say whether it will spur millions of fans to pay $11 to see footage of his tour rehearsals a full 4 months after he's died, especially considering that between now and then, the media will once again be full of stories about his excesses after the coroner's office releases a long-awaited toxicology report. Fans forgive everything when media icons die at the peak of their appeal, especially if they have lived fast, died young, and left behind a beautiful corpse. But Jackson and the fate of his upcoming film falls into a very different and very nebulous category. He didn't die young and vital. In fact, at 50, he was largely washed up, his slender frame a frail, disfigured reminder of the exuberant young sensation who once ruled the 1970s and 1980s pop charts.
Right, but to catch up, Alonzo, on what we argued about last week, Michael doesn't think that people are going to go see a movie like that, and he thinks that $60 million was way too much to spend. I totally disagreed.
Well, I mean, look, people were willing to buy tickets to those London shows where I think the insurer said that he had to be on stage for 13 minutes, and that was probably the max they were going to get, assuming he showed up at all. And still, people were willing to take that chance to see him, even at 50, even past his prime, even as culturally irrelevant as he had become before dying. So yeah, I think that there's you know, now that he has passed, I think there's going to be a lot of want to see factor. And even if they don't make $60 million back theatrically, the DVD will sell through the roof.
See, well, Michael.
I certainly want to see the film. I'm sure we all would see the film. But again, we're talking about rehearsal for a concert film. I think people will see it, but it will have to be the top grossing concert film of all time by like 100% just for them to start breaking even. $60 million, and then you.
But you have to remember. I mean, Sony is his label too, so they're going to have the soundtrack action on that.
That's
true.
All you care about. And, you know, if Michael Jackson dies, I want to be selling his CDs. I don't want to be selling a book about Michael. I don't want to be selling a documentary film showing him practicing a song. I want to be selling the albums because that's where you'll make the most money.
I mean, this is like a dress rehearsal, though. I mean, it's not just like chalk on the floor rehearsing, right? I mean, I was my understanding that it's for all intents and purposes what the London shows were going to look like.
Yeah, they had the stage up at the Staples Center and everything. They had all the pyrotechnics, and they were dress rehearsals.
They did not do a full run through of the show where you're getting basically a concert film. It's him, according to his manager, you know, according through Roger Friedman at Showbiz 411. It's him going half strength through a lot of songs, stopping, starting. It's watching him rehearse, work with the dancers. It's a documentary film. It's not like you're going to go and sit down and hear 20 songs performed full strength by Michael the way you would have at the concert. It's not that at all. At least that's what it's been described to us. Michael Jackson's a phenomenon. He sold a couple million. I think he sold about 5 million copies of his albums in the last month, 5, 6 million copies, which in this day and age is like selling 15 million copies. And but I just, you know, it's just as a financial deal. It's not about a question whether it's a good movie or bad or whether it be interesting or whether I'll go see it. But just as far as how those films do, like say Michael Moore had a documentary film available. He's the best, most successful documentary filmmaker of all time. Would you pay $60 million for Michael Moore's next documentary film? You shouldn't, because chances are it won't make your money back, even with DVD sales. You know, it's just not going to happen. His second highest grossing documentary film of all time is like $25 million. You know, Fahrenheit made $119 million, and then Sicko made $24 million, then Bowling for Columbine made $21 million. And, you know, that's the record that you have.
Yeah, so, you know,
I suspect that Sony didn't want anybody else to get it. That might be why they spent so much, just because they are so vested in the Michael Jackson business. They didn't want to miss out on the opportunity of the CD or the DVD or any of the ancillary stuff. They might have just seen it as a lost leader to keep it all under their umbrella than to let some other company have that chunk of Michael to run off with.
There was news actually this week about another troubled young singer. Well, I guess Michael Jackson wasn't so young. But Amy Winehouse is only 25, I think, and the Daily Mirror in London is reporting that her father faked a heart attack to try and get his daughter off of heroin. Did anybody read this story?
I did.
He says here, "I was at me wit's end. I just didn't know which way to turn." Apparently, Amy Winehouse's father is Popeye. "I'd tried everything. I pretended I was seriously ill. I pretended I was seriously ill and even got our doctor to tell Amy that I was dying. Once I even started screaming and said I was having a heart attack, but it didn't work. Amy's not stupid and she wanted to see my medical records proving I was actually ill." He goes on to say, "I just want all her fans to know that she's back, drug-free, and she will be making amazing music again very soon." Apparently, her father got to her somehow, and she hasn't been doing drugs since December.
Well, I hope that's true.
I'm still stuck on Amy's not stupid. Sorry.
I mean, her last two albums, you know, including Frank, are terrific albums. So hopefully she'll get her act together and make more good music.
Well, she was certainly on her way to being another Janis Joplin or another Jimi Hendrix.
A drug casualty.
Or at least a Pete Doherty, where she just shambles about for a while and then, you know, doesn't make music nearly as good.
No, I sincerely hope she gets her act together because, yeah, she's a talented young lady.
I guess the question is, will an Amy Winehouse with her act together be as entertaining, be as talented, and be as engaging? I think the answer to that is possibly so. She's going to have to get a good producer.
Talent is talent, and I think she's unquestionably talented. I think that she will probably be more successful without the drugs. Maybe I'm naive.
Well, we've never seen a clean and sober Amy Winehouse, so she may well surprise us.
Who knows?
We might have in the studio, as long as she's smart enough to get the Dap Kings, the incredibly good New York band that backed her up on her Back to Black album. As long as she gets them again and pays them right, then she'll be doing well.
Well, and supposedly she now has a visa to enter the United States, but the visa restrictions are she has to remain drug-free. Her father did go on to talk about how, you know, she does tend to drink a little too much.
A little bit, huh?
And she exercises.
That's his idea of drug-free, that she still drinks?
Well, he did say, the fear, of course, is that she's replaced one addiction with another, and we're keeping our eye on that. And the other addictions that she has replaced heroin with are an addiction to exercising. She exercises 3 hours a day, and shopping. So I don't know why somebody's bells aren't ringing here. Those are like really big signs of bipolar disorder and manic depression.
Well, let's get her to a doctor.
There's nothing like analyzing somebody across the pond that you've never met. You
yes.
sound like a U.S. senator now.
Yeah, I think that's a sign we're going to move into our last story, which is my
yes.
favorite, Inside Baseball.
Well, actually, I was just trying to get like some people to email us and you know tell me off. That would really
okay. Well, that'll probably work too.
Start the email controversy.
Alonzo, every week we have what we call Inside Baseball, which is what our listeners probably know absolutely nothing about, but as insiders ourselves, we love to talk about.
Oh, well, that's welcome to my life.
Exactly, right? And this week, I don't know, Sperling, you've got a few here, but should we talk about Ben Stiller's super secret video, Mocking Fox?
I think that's pretty much the only one we should talk about.
Have you guys seen it?
I have.
Oh, excellent. Yes. All right. And what did we think? Was it funny?
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously not intended for general consumption, you know, and hopefully his new bosses at Fox found the humor in it. But no, it was fine. I've seen better ones of those. There was one that involved the South Park guys on the Universal lot. I forget who made that one, but no, it was pretty good, I thought.
Well, just to give listeners some sense of what's going on here, Ben Stiller moved his production company to 20th Century Fox. And to commemorate that, he made this video that kind of mocks Tom Rothman, the head of Fox, and Rupert Murdoch, the person who owns News Corp, Fox's parent company. And it made its way around Hollywood, I guess on DVD and also over the internet. And should I try and play a couple clips of it?
I found this video incredibly derivative, actually. I didn't think it was really all that funny.
He definitely pulls no punches with Tom Rothman, and he goes on to say that he has, unknowing to Rupert Murdoch, gone on to be adopted by him as his sole heir.
Yeah, I think this is all very toothless. I think that Tom Rothman has it as his screensaver. He's delighted. Oh my God, Ben Stiller said my name. It's like having Letterman curse the heads, the suits at GE. It's just,
true.
You know, it's totally harmless and they're not offended. It's not risky or, you know, ballsy at all. It's just, you know, a cute little thing that Tom Rothman probably loved. I'm sure he did.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I did like the bit where he shows the history of Fox and it's just one explosion after another and Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah. That was the funniest bit.
Yeah, I don't think he really tried that hard to keep it from getting out to the public. It's not like those juicy moments from the I Heart Huckabee set, you know, which you know they didn't want to get out.
Exactly.
Or poor Christian Bale on Terminator.
Ah, yes.
My absolute favorite.
Well, now, Alonzo, we have to thank you for joining us today. Again, we should point out do you have anything other than your book, which 101 Must-See Movies
for
Gay Men?
It's still available on Amazon. I am working on a second book, but it's more than a year away. So hopefully you'll have me back, and I'll talk about that when it's done.
Absolutely.
But, I'm at MSNBC.com. You can see me most weeks on the Rotten Tomatoes show on Current or at current.com/movies. And, there I am.
And your website, AlonzoDuralde.com.
Right. AlonzoDuralde.
We hope you were writing fast. If not, for links to all of the stories we discussed on this episode, visit our website at showbizsandbox.com and look them up in the show notes. Our website is also where you'll find links to all of our social network accounts, including Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. If you want to email us specifically, you know, to talk about, say, somebody diagnosing Amy Winehouse with bipolar disorder, you can do so by emailing dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's toll free, 888-567-7263. If you want to send us news stories in another way other than voicemail and email, you can do so through the social bookmarking website delicious.com. Just tag your links, Showbiz Sandbox, all one word. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each episode of Showbiz Sandbox is by the ever-popular indie and no doubt twee band MGMT. You can visit their website at whoismgmt.com or find them at myspace.com/MGMT. If you want to see the band in person, you can catch them opening for Paul McCartney at Fenway Park on August 5th and 6th before they head off for a few dates in Europe. Does anybody else have anything that they, any news bits they want to add as we say goodbye?
Oh, I do have one last thing to plug. I'm sorry.
Sure, go ahead.
I am if you're in Los Angeles, I have co-curated a series called So Bad They're Brilliant at the American Cinematheque. It is running August 13th through 19th. Five nights of great, awful movies. You can find out more at AmericanCinematheque.com.
What are the movies?
Kitten with a Whip, Lonely Lady, Xanadu, Staying Alive, Mahogany, A New Kind of Love, Lost Horizon, Glitter, and From Justin to Kelly.
And for anybody that hasn't been to the American Cinematheque here in Los Angeles and that lives in Los Angeles and can make it, they should. It's a great theater. It's at the Egyptian Theater, which is the old, I don't know when it was built, I think the 30s.
Yeah, the 20s maybe even. This is one of the Grauman theaters, like the Chinese. The Egyptian, it's been restored to its sort of art deco outside, but the inside is a state-of-the-art screening facility with stadium seating.
It's fantastic. If you visit Los Angeles or are in Los Angeles, definitely go check it out. Well, guys, thank you very much.
Thank you, Alonzo.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Until next week, play nice.